And good afternoon, and welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Leigh Petty Fink, and Laurent is off because last week was Father's Day.
All right.
He gave us a reason. Were you listening?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
He gave us a reason. I can't remember. It was 2-3 weeks ago that he told us. I know. And Petty and I are looking at each other like, yeah, who has a memory for two, three weeks ago? Our guests today are from the City of Dallas LGBT Employee Association of Dallas. They're city employees. Brian Price is with the Planning and Urban Design Department.
That's correct.
Okay. And Teresa O'Donnell's joining us on the phone. She's the Chief Resiliency Officer for the city. She used to be the Assistant City Manager. Teresa, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Brian.
Good. I'm going to have to fiddle with the board in order for them to hear you. So there might be a couple of times where I'm the only one hearing you. But
just know that
if somebody says something, like if Patty kind of gets kind of, it's because she didn't hear what you were saying. What is Chief Resiliency Officer? I know you make us. You make us resilient, chiefly.
Actually, it's received a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. Rockefeller decided to fund resilience plans in 100 cities around the world, and Dallas was one of those grants. It's only 24 cities are U.S. and the rest are international cities, so it's a real honor for the City of Dallas to be included in this kind of group of some of the greatest cities around the world, like London and Paris and Barcelona and Rome. And so I kind of got lucky and was appointed by the former city to represent the city in administering this grant for the city.
Good. Okay. Now, for some reason, that button is not working. This is KNON. So I can hear you. The others can't.
I'm sure it was a wonderful explanation.
It was a great explanation of what she does. She does resiliency.
Okay.
I'm just catching them up a little bit.
Okay.
And Brian, you work for Planning and Urban Design.
I do.
Did you design like this mess that we have right out here in
75?
Yeah.
No, I don't do any traffic
engineering. Oh, okay, good.
No.
What type of planning do you do?
I do neighborhood planning. I started with the city in 2012 with a neighborhood investment program with the housing department, and now I work with Neighborhood Plus, the city's premier neighborhood planning and development organization. We have a number of target areas around the city, and I manage the Elm Thicket North Park target area process. Essentially, we're just trying to help streamline city resources and departments at the neighborhood scale more effectively and work with certain neighborhood groups to develop a vision for how they want their neighborhood to develop and bring the right partners to the table to see effective implementation. And in my case, this neighborhood's changing very quickly, result of market changes, and we're working with the neighborhood to help have more of a say in how the neighborhood develops. But every target area is different.
Do you know what a lot of neighborhoods need? They need more CVSs.
This is David's thing.
Or a Walgreens right next to it.
Across the street.
Seriously, okay. I mean, does your department, what you do, does that involve like things like food deserts?
Absolutely.
All that kind of stuff. When you talk about planning, that's a big deal.
So planning in a very creative sense. Planning's often shoehorned as just writing a plan. In this case, it's very action-oriented. It's we're more develop strategic action documents. So we bring the partners to the table in the process. So if we identify the issue of a code issue and the need for education on how to keep your home up or home repair needs in the neighborhood or food deserts, bringing a nonprofit to the table or bringing the resources to make a community garden happen, you know, we try to bring those resources into the process. So the plan we develop at the end is actually a fairly short action document, but hopefully the programs and the partners have been aligned at that point. So implementation's already in place as it is in the Elm Thicket target area currently.
You know, one of the things I'm known for at my job, where I've been for 20 years, is that I have a militant attitude against a non-word that people use all the time, and that's pre-plan. There's no such thing as pre-plan to me.
That's planning.
If you're pre-planning, you're planning.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, we have some very supportive council members. I work with Councilmember Medrano in District 2 for this target area. And we set up an advisory council early on, and that's really helpful for mediating the process. You know, just working with the quote, community, you know, as a mass of people is one thing. But working with leaders who are respected in the neighborhood, who can help us interpret what we're listening to, and really it's a work group. You know, we sit down and work about twice a month for 2 or 3 hours and plan out events and develop strategies. And so that's, I mean, that's really important. And having a council member that's supportive, having neighborhood leaders at the table is all really helpful to the process, I think.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good.
It is. Teresa, tell us a little bit about, as resiliency officer, helping us all be more resilient. I'm really trying to just confuse Brian and Patty here in the studio.
Mostly just Patty,
because Brian knows what you do, and it makes sense to him. Brian's a very gay job, making the neighborhood...
Very fabulous.
Very, very fabulous, okay, right. Yes. Making neighborhoods fabulous, right.
Should be our new slogan.
Mm-hmm. Right. You used to be assistant city manager. I had a question. I just completely lost it in my nonsense. You used to be assistant city manager. Tell us how this job, this is a special assignment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's not as fabulous as Brian's job, but it is awesome. So it's more lesbian than it is gay, I would say. Because it
her
is
her job's
awesome.
More lesbian than gay. That I had to relate to.
Oh, I would agree. And thank God, Teresa, that you're mm-hmm. more of a lesbian job than making everything fabulous.
Right.
We want it to work.
It has to do more than look good. It has to work. What we've been focusing on in our resilience plan is the long term stresses that kind of impede Dallas's ability to be really successful, and most of those, not surprisingly, would be economic and social stresses, like the fact that Dallas enjoys about a 3.7% unemployment rate, but in some areas of South Dallas, that unemployment rate can be as high as 18%.
Mm.
The fact that we have such an education disparity, the fact that we have this growing income equality. So I'm looking at those factors that have to do with social and economic justice, and how we can make Dallas a more equitable community for everyone who lives here.
You know what? We just got you on the monitor in the studio, okay. So now they can hear you. And I just lost, again, what I was going to say. Let's go on to the reason that we asked the two of you to come on the show today. City Hall celebrated Pride this month. And they've done that for several years, but this year was really fabulous.
Thank you very much.
Yes. That's Brian's country. Yes.
Fabulous, Brian's, and it works.
Yes.
But one thing that the city did that was really kind of amazing was this museum exhibit that will be on display through the end of the month, so till Friday? Friday. It'll be on exhibit in the lobby of City Hall. If you walk in the front door, and I'm telling this to anybody who's listening who wants to see it, walk in the front door, and it's just right across the lobby.
Near the big, giant rainbow flag.
Yeah, you can't miss that rainbow flag. First of all, Teresa, where do you get a rainbow flag that big?
I guess Flags R Us. I don't know, is it? It's really great.
That probably goes to Councilmember Medrano's office and Monica for pulling that together with the task force.
Yeah.
The flag itself.
Yeah. I mean, it's this huge rainbow flag flying in the lobby of City Hall. But the exhibit goes through, you know, it's not everything. You can't put everything into one because it's a small exhibit. It's, you know, only one wall of the lobby with some display cases. But it's a good representation of different things that have happened in Dallas in the LGBT community since the 19—there's one or two things in the 60s and then a little bit more in the 70s through the AIDS crisis and taking us up to the current time. When Brian and I were talking before the show, and he said you'd be able to talk more about this, it hints at the culture shift that's gone on at Dallas City Hall from, well, let's just be real honest, Teresa. When you and I were younger, and but there's been a culture shift, and one of the things that was really a watershed issue was when Micah England applied to be on the Dallas Police Force.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like working at City Hall, you know, 25 years ago?
Well, you know, I want to really take a moment to kind of praise Brian and all the things that he's been able to do in the last year or so with the employee organization. Because I think 25 years ago, I think Dallas was on the cutting edge of starting to show be tolerant. And that progressed. I think we made good progress on that over a number of years. And then, Patty, what was it, 4 or 5 years ago when we did the resolution?
The LGBT task force actually began in 2009.
Yeah, so I think
under
kinda,
then council member De Hasso.
That's right. And I think the city started to make an interesting pivot then from being tolerant to being inclusive. And I think Brian and the employee group that he is president of, and he's out there in an actively participatory way. And I wouldn't you say, Brian, that we've kind of gone from tolerance to real inclusion and participation now? I think it's been a really interesting shift over the last 7 or 8 years.
I would say, you know, with the employee group, you know, our humble contribution is really made possible because of what the task force has done and what, you know, what a lot of the heroes, many of them represented in the history exhibit, have done. You know, the heavy lifting, you know, in terms of formal policy as well as just making City Hall an affirmative location to work. And you know, there are other employee resource groups that have been active for longer. The Black Employee Association, there's an Asian and a Hispanic one, HACER, as well. And they've all been very friendly to work with and very welcoming. So I think City Hall's really been upping its angle on diversity and inclusion. And because of all that work, by the time we were formed, you know, we had all this support and all these resources in place. I think at the time, City Manager AC Gonzalez, it was a priority of his and ethics and diversity to make this organization successful. And at the time, we were pushing hard for the Municipal Equality Index score. And one of those components was having an LGBT employee association. And Teresa, I think as you once said before, it's like, you know, why doesn't this group exist? You know, why isn't it here yet? Maybe we could have been more helpful during the years when City Hall culture wasn't quite as welcoming. But now, you know, it's still, even in a welcoming environment, having an organization to be a part of, friendly faces that you can network with and be involved in the community with. And what I keep saying over and over to my organization is that, you know, we try to do really good work with pride events, with service events, and social events so people feel welcome. But the biggest thing that we do is existing and associating the two concepts, City of Dallas and LGBT, putting those two things together as often as possible. So when new employees are there or someone's deciding to come out or whatnot, they know, just like I got an indication, Teresa, you were on the It Gets Better video, and at the time, you know, I started with the city in 2012. I didn't know what to, how to make sense of this new environment. And at the time, I was brought in as a contract employee, so I wasn't permanent yet. So you always deal with these little calculations. You know, should I tell my coworker about my weekend plans with my partner, or just not say anything about my personal life, which is often what I'd end up doing. So seeing that video and I think, you know, social events like what we do really just help affirm that you are equal to everyone else around you. You can talk about your weekend plans. You can bring your partner to the, you know, the picnic that the department puts on. And that's, you know, hopefully what we try to accomplish.
And I think it makes a big difference. There's a lot of, we know a lot of LGBT people at the City of Dallas. Out of those 13,600 employees, there's some gay people, some trans people, some bi people, and we've been there for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going back to the Micah England case, and we just have a minute before we need to take a break. With Micah England, were you working for the city at the time?
No, I was not.
You were not yet, because, I mean, that was really a horrible case. Micah had
John Rogers might have been.
He might have.
Yes,
yeah.
He probably was.
Micah applied to work for the Dallas Police Department, and because being a lesbian violated 2106, the penal code of the Texas Constitution, Dallas Police Department had a policy that they would not hire, and what was the word that they used? Deviants.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. That was their word. But it went to court, and that was the first time 2106 was actually thrown out. And because it was thrown out, actually, well, no, that's not the case that threw it out, though.
No.
That wasn't the case. That was
Lawrence
Baker.
V. Texas.
No, but the first time, that was Baker.
Right.
Don Baker, who was president of Dallas Gay and Lesbian Alliance, and he was suing over something, over employment policies at DISD. But she won the case, but was still not hired by Dallas Police at the time. But she paved the way for so many lesbian cops who, some of them were on the force before her, but
and
you know, had to be real quiet about it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I hadn't heard, I knew nothing about that case. Mm-hmm. And I think many folks, many LGBT folk and younger folk like I, who didn't live through any of that or weren't engaged in the community, you know, seeing that history told in an exhibit like this and starting to learn those stories is really important. I really applaud the good work of the Dallas Way, their outrageous oral events they put on, and, you know, just starting the pioneering work of telling their history in a city that really typically ignores its history. No, I don't mean the organization specifically. I mean, you know, the city of Dallas and its relationship to history telling has often been complicated.
Yeah, when we're telling history, it's like, ooh, look at that building all the way down the street. It's more than 20 years old.
Right.
Yeah, and that's history. Right. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Deviants Brian Price and the late Patty Fink. And
proud to be.
Uh-huh. And Deviant Teresa O'Donnell is on the phone with us. She does resiliency for the city. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
This is Rollins Gilland, and I'm listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3. And darn glad to be doing it.
And this is Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink. Lauren will be back with us next week. We're talking to members of the LGBT Employee Association of Dallas. Brian Price is the group's president. Teresa O'Donnell isn't.
Isn't the president? She's a member.
She's a member of the group. One of the things that we're talking about, and one of the reasons that we invited the two of you on, is because of this wonderful Dallas gay and lesbian and bisexual transgender community history exhibit, museum quality history exhibit, that is in the lobby of Dallas City Hall, and it'll be there through the end of this week. And it's worth going if you're downtown or can get downtown. Go. It's really something that the whole LGBT community here should be very proud of.
And we have, a couple real big points about that. You know, the City Hall lobby underwent major renovation a year ago, maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what made, so there's been a flurry of exhibits in the lobby. You could always check it out. The Black Employee Association Best did a Black History Month exhibit, I think in partnership with Dallas Black History Organization, the museum, I think, and they put on a wonderful exhibit, which sort of gave me the initial inspiration. I'm like, we need a Dallas LGBT history exhibit. And so I started doing a little bit of research, talking to folks with the task force. It led me to the Resource Center. It led me to the Dallas Way. And they said, well, the materials have gone to UNT, which I had read before. And I called UNT and I said, hey, do we have an exhibit that you can just, drive on down here? And they go, well, we have some originals. We put on an informal exhibit. And so, we don't really have a true exhibit ready to go. And then they called me back a week later and said, you know what? We're going to design one for you. We are going to design this from scratch, and the Dallas Way is going to fund the printing and mounting of this exhibit. So they pulled that out in, 5-6 months, and Jamie with the library and I'm blanking on the other names, but Jamie was the one of the main workers who, you know, dedicated a lot of time to getting this done. So, I mean, a real special thanks to those two organizations for making this happen. I'd like to claim all the credit for it. Maybe I can just claim some of the creativity, the inspiration for it.
Okay, so when you saw the exhibit, it's basically it's a timeline. It goes through a number of events that happened. What that you saw, since you weren't here through most of that, what that you saw was most surprising to you, or that stood out, or that you think about when you think of that exhibit?
Oh, what stuck out? Well, I think I've seen bits and fragments of this from various friends of mine who lived through those times. Seeing it all compiled in one place and seeing that the flow to that history, the case of the Micah was really striking to me, and I got to see her speak at the Outrageous Oral event, and that touched my heart quite a bit. You know, her story that she wanted to be a police officer and she wanted to live in the big city, and just the treatment she received, you know, even after the policy was removed, was shameful. You know, what did kind of stand out to me, and I know this goes to that history telling piece, is there's a lot of great points on that timeline, but also just as much as striking, and this is acknowledged by all partners involved, is what is also missing from the timeline. We do miss the stories of people of color and transgender history, and I think history telling of more marginalized groups is always a harder enterprise, because their stories are not often told in the formalized ways through formal organizations or formal policies passed, but it's informal. It's informal groups of people behind the scenes. And so I really do hope that we can continue to build that story. So by way of not answering her question,
let me get to Teresa.
It is sort of, as we say, pale, male, and stale through much of that exhibit.
Yeah, except Patty, you're in the exhibit, so you're an artifact.
Teresa, I'm an idiot, so
you are. Teresa, when you saw the exhibit, what struck you? What did you see that you said, "Oh yeah, I forgot about that," or something?
You know, like Brian was saying, it's those personal narratives, I think, that touch people, not only gay and lesbian employees, but straight employees that might have questions. Or I think with the national politics going on and all the us versus them and people trying to instill fear and hate in folks, I think it's so important to have those narratives so that LGBT people are seen by our heterosexual counterparts as just normal, everyday people. Like Micah, who have dreams and aspirations and just want to lead, a regular life, not being harassed or singled out. And I think that goes a long, long way. I think it inspires a lot of conversations. I think it causes people to step back and reflect and really understand that, we're all just human beings, right?
And do you know what struck me? There was a photo in the one of the panels is about the Turtle Creek Corral. So there's a photo of I don't think it was the original corral, but I think it was like 1 or 2 years into its formation. And I'm looking at the faces, and most of them are gone. There was another picture. It's of a Dallas Gay and Lesbian Alliance board, and it's one of the early boards. Other than two people, they're all gone. It was a reminder to me of how devastating the AIDS crisis was here in Dallas. And without knowing the faces, you wouldn't know that. On the tours of the exhibit that I gave, people got that. And I've given a bunch of tours whenever I've been down there. Even people I don't know, I just stopped and said, oh yeah, that's...
You should give a walking tour of it.
Mm-hmm. <I'll>, yeah. the other one that I loved,
30 feet and then come back, mm-hmm. Right.
The other one that I loved is there's a good exhibit of Guts. Guts was our ACT UP,
yeah.
But Guts was formed before ACT UP was formed, so we came up with our own name. Guts stood for Gay Urban Truth Squad, which reminded me I have to donate my Guts t-shirt to UNT so that they'll have it for future exhibits. I don't wear it often anymore.
but it certainly struck me that some of the actual, not the the wall exhibit, but in the glass cases, you know, each one has a theme related to different kinds of organizations that were involved. You know, there's still a lot of great, like, sports and culture organizations, but I didn't quite realize how old some of these groups were.
Mm-hmm.
Like the sports groups, the volleyball group. I mean, I knew about the Turtle Creek Corral. I'm a singer as well, but you know, these organizations were essential, you know, during the 80s and 90s, mm-hmm. to provide culture and belonging, and so that was just seeing the shirts and the, you know, the pieces of that element of the history was very touching.
HRC used to have a saying, if anybody called them and said, we're trying to start a group on such and such, they'd say, oh, call Dallas, they have one of those.
Well, we have that reputation across the country, mm-hmm. as an innovative, creative, organized is the big key word there, community. And we almost have sometimes too many organizations.
Well, but things like the Victory Fund started, mm-hmm. with William Wayburn at Crossroads Market, and he was their first executive director up in Washington. The Black Tie Dinner
started here.
HRC had this idea.
They
traveled around the country. Dallas is the one that picked it up. Their employee group, just the idea of an employee resource group. The first one was League at AT&T.
And I didn't know that. I had no idea it started here.
Wow, I didn't.
And so just the concept of it. The second one was Texas Instruments, I believe. I believe they were the second one.
And
if
their famous high-tech happy hours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was huge. It was a gathering of people who were professionals,
mm-hmm.
engineers from all over, and it was just an amazing thing. They would have high-tech happy hour all over Oak Lawn and in Uptown, and people would come from all over. I don't know if they still do them anymore.
Yeah, they do. They just renamed them. They rebranded it. they did that just this year.
But we have the first LULAC Rainbow Chapter, mm-hmm. and now they're all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
That was Jesse Garcia,
mm-hmm.
Who's living in D.C. now. We had the first National Coming Out Day project that was here in Dallas. The first oldest, longest running LGBT radio show anywhere in the country, right, mm-hmm. here in Dallas. That's us.
Wow.
So we have that reputation.
Mm-hmm. On Thursday this week, as part of your Pride Month celebration, the Pride Month celebration started with the opening of this museum exhibit in the lobby of City Hall. Thursday you did a transgender workshop or panel discussion
forum.
Tell us about it.
Yeah, part of our mission with the organization is to provide educational opportunities, you know, related to LGBT issues here in City Hall. And we've known for quite some time now we wanted to do a transgender forum related discussion. We know that of all the issues that our community faces, that one persists to be the one that folks are educated on the least, even within our own community, but certainly in the workforce at large. So Johnny Gaston with my organization really helped pull together some of the speakers, and I can let maybe Patty talk a bit about, she's known more of them personally, but we had an amazing conversation. I didn't know what to expect. I heard that before my organization was formed, about a month before, they tried to do a senior LGBT housing discussion, and they got two employees to show up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was it probably wasn't promoted the way that we, now that there's an organization, now that we can really push the message and take ownership, I didn't know what to expect. And we ended up having 35 people in that room, and it's recorded. So eventually I'm going to put that up on our Facebook and our website, so that'll be available. We might edit it down if we have time, but otherwise the full hour was just a tremendous conversation. Mm-hmm. I was nearly moved to tears just a couple times hearing comments like, I transitioned because, and I came out about it because I wanted the pain to stop, you know, knowing all the repercussions. You know, when you really learn that the transgender discussion can get wrapped up in pronouns, and it can feel difficult and controversial, but at the heart of it, it's about people trying to explore themselves, be authentic, but when you hear about just the small ways in which they're just absolutely terrorized by the political right, by culture in general, it's really it was a very touching conversation, Patty, and I'm sure I'm missing some main elements.
Well, I thought it was a really well done event, and I hope you're going to have more. I think that would be a really great opportunity for people at the city, people who don't work at the city of Dallas, to participate and hear those stories. I think they're very powerful. And we're not good at it in our own community. In the LGBT community, the LGB can really suck sometimes with regard to the D. And we've got to do a better job. And I think certainly, as you were saying earlier about the exhibit, the experiences that trans people of color have in their lives, it's something we really need to be cognizant of and vigilant about.
The Reverend from Cathedral of Hope made that point about what we should be doing, the LGB, our role as allies. And he made some really good points about that.
What are some of them?
Well, namely, our job is to do the heavy lifting of educating ourselves to make life easier for people, with a different gender ID identity or who are transitioning. You know, we need to do that work and not put the heavy burden of education just on transgender individuals to tell us, you know, what needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I thought Neil did a really good job about saying it needs to not be a white male world anymore, because the whole world is changing, demographics are changing, and white males are not going to be the leading predominant force in things, and so we need to acknowledge that. And part of that with regard to the trans community is giving space for people of color to tell their stories, and I think that's a great forum. And I noticed of the questions coming from the audience, they were primarily people of color asking questions. And also one of a comment from the audience was an expression of bringing that to communities of color, the need to for that education to happen, which I thought was very, very telling and a very good point.
The first transgender group for transgender people of color, where was it? Right here in Dallas. Again, we're in the middle of creating those groups, because that's what we're good at here in Dallas.
We are
good at that. So where does, you know, it's one thing to just have a forum, it's one thing to have a museum exhibit. The museum exhibit, every time I've been there, there have been people wandering through and looking at it. It sounds like this forum was very successful. I mean, obviously, we have a special session coming up, but that's a special thing that for a month we have to try to make sure that we don't get stupid laws about where people go to the bathroom. I think we know how to go to the bathroom, and we don't need the state telling us how to go to the bathroom. But where do we take it from here? You know, beyond the silly bathroom issue, because I say it a silly bathroom issue. Are you planning more forums? Are you planning on bringing it out? Not everybody works in Dallas City Hall who works for the city.
The exhibit, apparently UNT's already gotten many requests for that exhibit to move on. So I think because the materials were sent up to Denton and it had never been put in a quite as graphically elaborate of a presentation, that much of the history hasn't quite filtered back yet. So I think we're very excited to have that. As far as, you know, what to do next, it's interesting, you know, we're a humble little 55 member organization trying to make a work
environment.
Yeah,
don't make excuses for yourself. We expect results. This is Dallas.
My point is, what makes it funny is, you know, our main mission is to make the work and continue to promote a work environment that's friendly and accepting. But because we do represent employees with the city of Dallas, I think there's kind of a symbolic importance and prominence that is thrust upon us, you know, whether we plan for it or not. You know, I plan these exhibits. We plan these events, you know, mainly for city employees. Not that we, you know, we didn't have the public in mind, but having the exhibit in City Hall lobby and Teresa's point is probably the best. It starts conversations, and it just having a rainbow flag and a pride exhibit in City Hall, it takes these taboo, silent topics that we just assume not, you know, we're just going to assume not talk about it because we don't know how people are going to feel. And now just sort of putting in people's face and sort of making it okay, you you're walking by with your coworker and it's right there, you're going to say something. And, you know, with the Transgender Forum, you know, we ended up, a lot of the folks that showed up weren't city employees. And a lot of the folks who showed up for our exhibit unveiling were not city employees. And, you know, that was a surprise that was very pleasant. We did not expect that. So now that question's come up, you know, how do we continue to manage that role? Fortunately, a lot of the heavy policy lifting has been done by the task force and prior to us. So we're not having to face that question of where's that line between employees and, you know, activists. I mean, I'm curious if Teresa has any thoughts.
You know what, Teresa, we're going to ask you that right after the break. We need to take a break. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet. I'm here with the late Patty Fink. Lauren will be back with us next week. Teresa O'Donnell and Brian Price are with the LGBT Employee Association of Dallas. That's City of Dallas employees who are a little off-center.
Oh. So-called deviants.
But they're deviants.
Yeah. Deviant.
You know, if you ever change the name again, because you started off as CAPE.
I'll tell the story after the break.
Okay. we're suggesting the City of Dallas deviants. We'll be back with more right after this.
Hi, this is Valletta Lill, and I listen to Lambda Weekly. I hope that you will, too.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, and our guests are Brian Price and Teresa O'Donnell. Teresa's on the phone with us. Teresa, you were going to chime in about what was she going to chime in about, Brian? My head is like,
well, it's this dynamic, you know, there's a certain symbolic prominence that LGBT employees have. So, you know, going forward, our role as a community organization versus an internal facing organization, we continue to deal with that. You know, fortunately, we haven't had to chime in on political issues yet, but not that we've necessarily been afraid to do so. But
yeah, and Teresa, let's hear your comments on that.
Well, I think Brian's right. I think we've got I think he's doing and the association is doing a great job internally, but I also think that those benefits trickle out externally as well. I know that the task force and John Rogers and I were both asked by other governmental organizations when we were going through changes at City Hall. We became an example for other local governments like DART and the school district and the county about what those organizations were doing in terms of fairness and equality for their employees. And our city council has also done a great job. We have a big legislative lobbying team that goes down to Austin every year and lobbies for or against different bills. And I know that we have been LGBT rights have been well represented by the City of Dallas lobbyists in that regard, too. So I do think these things continue to reverberate outside City Hall. So not only are we of examples and leaders for our own employees, but for other employers and outside City Hall as well. It's struck me, I was really grateful for the bathroom bill this year, that we had those big major employers weighing in on the economic development opportunities that would be missed in the state of Texas if they tried to go forward with a bathroom bill. So I do think pressure can be applied in a lot of different ways. And to have City Hall down lobbying for LGBT rights in Austin, I think is a huge, huge step forward. And I'm really glad that council members like especially Philip Kingston and Scott Griggs made that part of the legislative agenda.
One of the reasons that LGBT issues and other city issues don't conflict with each other at all is because one of the ways the state wants to interfere is by taking away a city's right to do its own legislating, to write its own ordinances. So I was talking to a council person over in Fort Worth, and she said, you know, that one of the things they want to take away is our right to decide a speed limit on a local street. Now, if there are legislators in Austin who are from West Texas, their local streets might have, you know, 20 houses on you know, 5 miles of road, you can drive faster on that road than you can on a road in Fort Worth that has a lot of curves on it and lots of kids. And we're not trying to decide for Midland how their streets are, you know, with the speed limits on their streets. They should not want to take away our ability to do it on our streets. But it's in their zeal to take away our right to just say, here in Dallas, everybody's equal, employees get equal benefits, employers cannot discriminate, and we have a mechanism for people to file a complaint here. You don't want to do it in whatever city, you don't have to, but you don't have to legislate it from a state level. So those don't conflict at all.
I think one of the most ludicrous things, the representative in the Texas House from Carrollton has already stated that he's going to file two bills that could be considered bathroom bills, one of which would take away the power of a municipality to make an ordinance, to pass an ordinance, but there's no state protection at all for veterans. Mm-hmm. In Texas, there's no provision to protect veterans in the workplace or anywhere else. And so cities like Dallas have in our ordinance, in our city charter and code, Dallas city code, protections for veterans and anyone based on military status. And so this representative has said, oh, well, we'll have to figure out a way to continue to protect veterans, which just speaks to the targeting of trans people in this entire right. process and LGBT mm-hmm. people. That these ordinances, to take away the right to have an ordinance, is about LGBT people and denying them their rights, because he's wanting to find a way to save protections at the city level for veterans. Mm-hmm. And it's the whole thing is just insane mm-hmm. and infuriating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Teresa, how have you seen over the years, like back from in the, you know, early 1900s when you started with the city? You know, I remember you were on our show sometime in like 1930, 31. It was right at the very beginning of the Depression.
You made me hand crank the radio at that point. I remember, David, but okay, I'll let that go now.
Yeah, but so way back when you first started, how have you seen the relationship between the city and the LGBT community and LGBT employees really change?
Well, I think, and I probably have told this story on your show before, my wife and I have two kids. One is now 10 and one is 12. And when both of them were born, so one was born in 2005 and one was 2007, I was denied family medical leave when both my daughters were born, because the HR director and the city manager and the city attorney did not consider my children my children. And today, you know, the employees having kids today would not have that problem, because all of our HR rules and FMLA have been equalized now. But as recently as 2005 and 2007, that wasn't the case.
And you know, I sat through those really horrible, mean-spirited Dallas police and fire pension arguments about giving equal benefits to officers with same-sex partners. And one officer was trying to explain, and she did this twice on two consecutive months, that because it was her wife that gave birth to the child, her pension benefits would not include her child if something happened to her.
Yeah.
And after she sat down right next to me, I said, they're not getting it. You need to bring a visual aid next month. And she said, what do you mean? I said, bring the kid. I mean, it was so bad with some of these pension board people. They weren't understanding the concept lesbian has a child.
Yeah.
And how that even worked. They just weren't getting it. So they must have been picturing God knows what that she was actually talking about lives in her home with her. So the next month she brought her kid in her arms, and you could see that I saw several of the pension board people go, oh. And she told the exact same story that she had told two other times, this time with a kid in her hands. They got it.
Yeah.
But we've made progress there. So.
Yeah.
And you didn't quite tell that story last time you were on. Last time you had kids who were 8 and 10.
Oh.
She said they were 10 and 12. So.
That's right.
But I have to give Teresa huge kudos because she and John Rogers really mapped out for the task force the best way to approach all of these the recent developments that we've had in the equality resolution and how that would be structured and how we could get that passed. And I have to say it's been incredibly successful. I would say we have maybe one big thing left now to cross off, and that's protocols for transitioning on the job.
Mm-hmm. Teresa, talk about that a little bit. How you felt the best way to get through these policies were. And for people just tuning in, Teresa was the assistant city manager at the time. She's in a different position now. But
John Rogers at the time, who's now retired, was an assistant city attorney who had been there for a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. So what was the plan that you came up with? And it wasn't enumerating for the city council all the things that needed to be fixed or updated or changed or added.
You know, it was really a work, a collaboration between John and I and the task force. We had a really great task force. I think you and David probably sat in on all of those meetings, I think, and it evolved over time. It started as just an attempt to get a marriage equality resolution passed through the council, and that erupted. Didn't go well. That was introduced, I think, by Councilmember Griggs and maybe Pauline Medrano. And,
yeah, it was definitely Pauline because when Adam came on the council, they punished him by not making him mayor pro tem or deputy mayor pro tem for his first two terms. This time they didn't have a choice because the choice would have been Omar and to certain people on the council just as bad. So, yeah, but it was Pauline.
So we kind of started at that point. And then as the task force continued to talk and think and try to plan about what we thought was actually doable, we came up with this really great list of kind of small incremental steps that would, you know, put us on this path of greater equity at the city of Dallas. And it wasn't without controversy. There were some members of the task force that wanted to go, you know, a really big, bold splash and maybe put all their eggs in one basket. And then Patty, you were great in kind of helping John and I say, well, you know, with this council, we might want to identify a series of smaller things. But it came together really, really well. And then we had this unlikely hero in Jerry Allen, who was a council member at the time, and a lot of people just saw him as a, you know, a white, straight, male, conservative banker from Lake Highlands. But he allowed us to take all the time we wanted. He ran the Council Finance Budget and Audit Committee. And as chairman, he gave us the discretion to present just about anything that we wanted to present at his committee. And so it was a great educational experience for a lot of the council members who didn't realize that there were things that were unjust or not equitable at City Hall. And so it became an education experience. And I think, didn't we end up with a 13-2 vote, Patty? I think we got everybody.
We did. We did, and in fact, I'd just like to add, I thought Jerry Allen was an amazing champion for us. You're so right, Teresa. And when we did a photo at one of the Pride events in the flag room, the fall immediately following that, in 2015. He was behind us in the photo, and he said to me and to Pam Gerber, he said, working on all of this has been the proudest moment of my life.
Wow.
And it still makes me choke up, because he was amazing.
But you know something, somebody who understands finance, if you give them a good financial argument that if I'm married to my wife, I get this amount of money, and if I'm married to my husband, I don't. Or if I'm married to my wife, she gets my pension if I die. If I'm married to my husband, he doesn't. Somebody who understands finance understands it in dollars and cents, and you know, they just get it. The argument I like to ask CEOs when I've had the chance to talk to them when they've not given same-sex partner benefits back before marriage equality, you know, I'd say, well, how many gay or lesbian employees do you hire in order to keep the number of people whose spouses you have to cover low? So you maintain these as gay and lesbian jobs, positions? And, oh, no, of course not. So, you know, Patty's job is filled by a lesbian right now. You don't have to give her benefits. But if you replaced her immediately and replaced her with a heterosexual person who's married, you would give those benefits, yes. So it's not really a matter of dollars and cents, is it? It's really a matter of just discrimination, right?
Wow, that's powerful.
The HRC and the Municipal Equality Index really kind of banks on part of the leverage, as much as anything, is that you know, cities are in competition with private sector to draw in talent. And there became a, I'm not sure the entire history behind the Municipal the Equality Index for cities, but I think now there's a real pressure to score high. I mean, it's made its way to Dallas and to other cities as well. And that's part of the leverage is, you know, companies are now having to, you know, don't be known as a bigoted company. Or
well, there is, I won't mention their name, but there's a certain car company moving to Collin County, and their LGBT group, when they realized that they're moving from one of the most liberal counties in California to one of the most conservative counties in the United States, they had a fit. They had to hire somebody from our LGBT community to go out there and talk to them about things like, well, it's a quick drive down the tollway to Oak Lawn. You know, if you're looking for better schools, they're not going to discriminate against your kids in Plano schools. They had to actually hire somebody. You know, bigotry just doesn't really work in corporate America much anymore.
I mean, they might have read about some of the council disagreements in Plano.
Well, I think that's one of the great things about the city of Dallas is that when people like Jerry Allen can stand up for you, it's really amazing. And I was thrilled to see, it was the same year that I was Grand Marshal for the Pride Parade, and he was he had left office that May, and was asked to be a judge of the floats on coming down Cedar Springs on at Pride, and I was thrilled. I just, you know, wanted to jump down there and give him a hug, but we were waving at each other, and he really was just an amazing force for us, and not that other council members were not. There were tremendous council members who were there, but I think for really the first time, the council really began to see we have a significant sector in our employees, and it's a large number of employees. It's 13,000, almost 14,000 employees who are LGBT, and we've got to do better. And there's nothing that motivates people sometimes at City Hall, especially on the council, than saying the word Fort Worth. The word's Fort Worth. Because if Fort Worth is doing it, it's like Dallas is going to be there too.
And I have a question for the group, actually. And this ties into the history exhibit and this question of, you know, advancing progressive causes like LGBT issues with the City of Dallas. I guess, and by way of asking that question, Teresa, the first time that I saw you speak, I was at UT Arlington. We had a panel talking about Dallas. We had the author of critical book on the City of Dallas and its history, and And you were on the panel speaking, and one thing that was really refreshing about listening to you speak is, you know, you point out that planners often have good ideas and good causes in mind, but you sort of had this very realistic sense of how power works in a setting and how money works. And so I'm curious, and maybe it's after the break.
Well, it is. Show's over, but the late Ziggy Fink is not here yet to do the Ethiopian show. He will be here in a couple of minutes. I think I just saw a car drive into the parking lot. So let's just do our top of the hour.
And 89.3 FM in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people. You're listening to KNON.
And this is still Lambda Weekly because... next show isn't quite here yet. I think that's them that pulled into the parking lot. So they'll be here in a few minutes. So you're asking Teresa.
So the question was, like, you know, are there specifics to Dallas, like our political scene? Like, what are the kind of the rules of a game in this setting? And, you know, Teresa's been in the middle of working with the city. You guys have been advocates towards the city. You know, if we're, you know, this question about Dallas history and politics, like what is the lay of the land here, and how do you have to operate to make progressive change happen?
And you have 60 seconds to talk
about. Yeah, I'm not sure. I saw somebody else walk out of that car, so we're not sure. Go ahead, Teresa.
Quite a topic, though.
Well, I think, fortunately, because of the tone of the national conversation, has gotten so awful. I think that right now the city council and a large part of the citizenry in Dallas is very focused on equity. I think the timing is really good. We've managed to kind of put forward a pretty effective community dialogue right now about transportation equity and the importance of making DART run more efficiently and more effectively for transit-dependent people, as opposed to just building one more new shiny light rail line. Those light rail lines are important. But the fact that there are so many people in Dallas that are in poverty and the working poor really depend on transit to get to work, to get to jobs, to get to hospitals, to get to schools, that is really very important. And that and a number of other conversations about equity have really come to the forefront. And I think you're going to hear that more and more in the coming weeks, because there's a couple of exciting grants. Announcements, I think, that are going to be made next week by some big national foundations to talk about equity in Dallas. And so the time is right, not just for LGBT people, but anyone in Dallas, the residents of Dallas that for one reason or another haven't been given the same kind of opportunities to provide for themselves and their families, like, you know, people on this radio show have. You know, we're very blessed to have all the fortunes that we have in our lives. But so equity is a really good time. And if there's other kind of things that we need to capture or conversations that we need to have, I think now is the time to do it.
Teresa, I want to thank you for being with us. Next show is here. It'll take them a minute to set up. But I want to thank you for being with us again, and be resilient.
Thank you, David.
And Brian, thank you for coming in and make our neighborhoods gayer.
And thank you for having us. And
fabulous.
I wanted to thank also my other leaders in my association who've helped make the Pride Month events happen. Daniel Church and Felix and Johnny, all those folks helped make everything happen. So I just wanted to thank them.
Thanks for being here,
David. And we'll be back next week with more Lambda Weekly. Roger Waddell with the Texas Pride Impact Funds. I think he's next week.
I think he is, too.
Yeah. And we'll see you then.